Hi, I'm Gordon Lamphere, and welcome to the Real Finds podcast, where we have real conversations with key entrepreneurs, activists, and researchers shaping the real estate industry and, as a result, our world. On today's podcast, we'll be speaking with Sarah Escobar and Corinne Murray. Sarah and Corinne are workspace experts at developing strong teams in a post-2020 world and authors of Work Then Place. Sarah was the director of employee experience at Hulu, the VP of operations at Honey, and the director of experience at Netflix in LA. She has a strong track record at growing and maintaining teams in a post-2020 environment. Corinne was the head of Future of Workplace Practice at WeWork and the chief transformation strategist and founder of Agate. She's a leader in understanding and improving how work happens. On the podcast, we take a deep dive into the future of work, why it often sucks for employees, and how, with very few but small nudges, businesses can develop a much happier and much more productive work culture. It's well worth a listen.
Thank you so much for hopping on the podcast today.
It's good to see you, Gordon. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So, work, it's a pretty big subject. What got the two of you into the concept of like work and kind of how humans deal with tackling our day-to-day work?
I can go first. I feel like this is that part of what we wrote about is really my baby, in the sense that through my career, you know, I started in commercial real estate at CB. I went to corporate. I've done consulting on the design side, you know, on the co-working side. So I've really like taken this huge journey, all because I was trying to drill deeper into how do we enable work better? Because at the end of the day, that's what the workplace is intended to do. And commercial real estate serves that. So for me, it's always been sort of this through line of how do we make sense of all these things so that at the end of the day, every employee feels like they have what they need to be successful. Like that's the best metric of success that we can really come up with for real estate folks, workplace folks. So that's really why I have a borderline obsessive relationship with defining work and figuring out, you know, what are the components of it. So that way we as practitioners can do a better job of delivering on what makes it happen well.
Yeah. And in the way that Corinne was very linear and purposeful, I was on the opposite end of the spectrum of how I ended up in helping to define work. I was lucky enough to be employee number two at Hulu. This was in the early 2000s when the term workplace didn't exist. The people that were trying to manage buildings were very strictly facilities, and the only people really imagining how place could impact people was Google, but it kind of seemed like it was more to make everyone be at work a little longer, which who knows if that's really the reason. Don't attack me, Google, please. But that's, you know, what it seemed like. So I fell into this because we really truly cared at Hulu the experience that our employees had at work and believed that it would make them better at delivering for the business if they were happy. And so I kind of fell into creating the workplace department at Hulu, which at that time we called the culture team, and just figuring out what it meant to help enable people to do better work by making sure that their place supported them, and have been able to grow my career through that and went and got my master's in organization development because of it. Because I just didn't see people thinking about how groups and teams were enabled to do better work based on their place.
So all of that answers a little bit, but it also gives me a lot of questions.
It opens up more than it answers, right?
Yeah. And so one of the big questions from your book is like, I mean, what are the right questions, right? So what are the right questions around work and, you know, where it should be and how it should be, and how can we structure work in a way that creates the most productive environment for everyone?
Yeah, I'll hop in real quick because I think that's, you've hit on the exact foundation of why we wrote the book, right? It's we have both lived our careers with people saying the place should do this, or the place should be this. And frankly, the place is going to be driven by the work, by the people, by the culture. And so our book makes people back up and say, okay, what are we really looking for here? Are we looking for increased collaboration? Are we looking and why are we looking for, more effective, like, delivery of results, and why? And then how can place ultimately support that? But it's not about the place. It's really about the work.
Yeah. To add on to that, I think we've very, very carefully wanted to write this book as neutrally as possible. And that's saying a lot, especially for both of us. Like, we have our very, you know, we are opinionated people. We obviously took the time to write the book.
We are anything but neutral.
We took the time to write this thing. So we have opinions, but, you know, not everyone lives in a coastal city working for a big corporation trying to figure out a global workplace strategy. So, you know, we really wanted to make sure that what we were doing was as translatable as possible for, you know, for a small and medium-sized business somewhere in the Midwest or somewhere in the Sun Belt and just, or somewhere in Europe or elsewhere around the world. So we really wanted to make sure that we said the right questions are first really just looking at what already exists. Like, auditing is the thing that we kind of always skip over when we think about what to do for the future. You know, I think as humans, we get really excited about, like, well, what's possible? And so we sort of dreamscape and project into the future instead of saying, well, where are we now? Like, we have to really, really know where we are now to build, to make sure we have the foundation to build said future and make sure that it's stabilized enough to be worth it and to actually deliver. And so I think that that's like the first question isn't really even a question. It's about taking stock. And that's not always something that people who, like, you know, when we get excited about looking forward, no one wants to look backwards. But unfortunately, it's the thing that we always should be doing to make sure that we have a full understanding of what's currently present, because that's usually where you get to see, that's where you find the gaps, you know, because the gaps in what exists today are what build the future, not, you know, tearing something down and starting from scratch on something new. It's this iterative and sort of, you know, building layer and layer on top of one another to create a composite of a workplace strategy or an organizational transformation, whatever that might look like, because it's all evolutionary. I think that's the other thing that we really wanted to drill in on is this is an evolution. It's not just, you know, we swing the hammers or we press the button and we're there.
So talking about the evolution of modern work, one of the things that I found about your book, as well as some of the other books that we've had on the podcast talking about work, that I think you did very well, was kind of the environments of modern work and kind of how we've evolved to get there. I'm curious, can you talk a little bit about that and, like, the three environments of the modern workplace?
Sure. So for me, this understanding really took, like, really deep root for me while I was at WeWork. And that was because at the time, we were doing a lot of really innovative work on the physical environment. You know, we basically were a think tank that never really got a lot of news because of some louder characters, but I don't know if you've heard of them. can't think of them. Anyway, so it really took root for me there because we were very focused on, like, how do we make this physical environment deliver on what we need? But then I kept hitting up against this, it not necessarily working. And it was because even though our own business, the thing that we were selling in the world, didn't train enough of the workforce on how to be adaptable to those types of environments. So there was a culture gap even within an organization that was selling the innovation, which I, you know, was such a conundrum and a hard thing for me to sort of wrap my head around, that it made me start to sort of fracture these things apart in a way that I hadn't before. So obviously there's physical transformation, which I think we're all understand the most. The digital transformation or digital environment isn't just the digital twins and the ticketing and all the things that like usually live within a real estate or facilities team already, but more about like the collaborative ecosystem where teams get work done. So where we are right now would count as one. Slack counts as one, you know, SharePoint, whatever sort of network you live on, that's the digital workplace. And we don't necessarily think about it as a workplace. So building those together, and then the culture is sort of like the, like it's the glue. It's the stuff that makes sure that, you know, what we do in the physical also makes sense in the digital. And so that there's this, you know, complementary existence, as opposed to, well, we have all these digital tools, but we don't necessarily have the places set up for us to enable them. An example Sarah gave, I think just in passing one day, was like, you know, we want people to collaborate and we want to make sure that everyone's connected around the globe, but we don't have enough phone booths. Or, you know, we want to make sure that people are in the office collaborating with one another when they're there, but we have an abundance of, you know, 2 to 3 people meeting rooms and not enough space for big team meetings. So it's reconciling those, you know, those irregularities is what, you know, really shapes out our concept of like the holistic workplace that then shapes how we define workplace strategy going forward.
And I found in the book that you had a couple really deep insights into this from what you did at Hulu. Could you dive into that a little bit?
Yeah, I think the deep insights into the physical, digital, experiential workplaces from Hulu are dramatically different for me than they are from post-COVID. I was a little more typical to, I think I was a little more typical to most people in work, where I didn't truly realize that there were 3 separate work environments until post-COVID. Yeah. And now it's just so dramatically obvious, I think, to everyone that those environments exist. That
COVID was just the inflection point that made it obvious.
Right. It just made it really, really obvious. Now, at Hulu, we were starting to experiment with that, but I don't think that I had truly realized the separation. It was at Netflix, which, yes, I went from Hulu to Netflix. It was at Netflix when I started the week that COVID hit, that we realized we didn't know how to get work done purposefully in the digital environment, because how do you produce a television show when you're not allowed to be together? And right. And so we worked really hard for a year or so to try and figure that out. I mean, remember at the beginning, we all thought it was going to be a couple of weeks, and then had to all figure out how to really adjust to this new reality. And all with the resistance of, no, this is going to go back to normal. Don't put too much work into it. Oh, we don't even recognize that 2020 normal anymore, right? And so we kind of said, yeah, we realize we've been working on this for years and years. It was the reason I invited Corinne to come in, is because she's one of the earliest people I know that was working on physical, digital, experiential environments as distinctively different because of that benefit of the WeWork thought process, right? And I think that we kind
of... We also just crashed into a lot of walls.
That's true. That's true. Let's give you the credit anyway. And we kind of said, how do we make this repeatable in a way that didn't even exist in 2020, which I think 5 years ago, we've been writing the book for 3 years. So we realized, you know, about 2 years into everyone realizing there are 3 different types of workplaces, that my God, this is going to have to become repeatable. Let's get something down that helps people make this repeatable.
So one of the things that I keep seeing repeat throughout my career, both starting out and going later into my career. And I thought your book did a great job of touching on it, is multi-generational workforces. Mm-hmm. And I remember, you know, picking up Time magazine when I was like 10 or 11 or 12 years old. And one of the first articles that I can remember is like, what are we going to do when the millennials get into the workforce, right? And then they're like, well, Gen X behave this way. The boomers behave this way. What will the millennials do? And now I can sit there and say, I have a child that's not even a Gen Alpha child.
Yeah.
And so we're going into, you know, we keep seeing this, and I'm sure I'll see something 10 years from now or 15 years from now that'll be like, what do we do with Gen Beta, right?
What's gonna do?
Yeah, what's Gen Beta? How will they survive, right? So I'm curious, what do you see in terms of generations in the workforce, generational expectations, without getting just ridiculous to yeah. spell papers?
Sarah, you've been in the workplace a little more consistently than I have.
Yeah.
I've been doing consulting. Sarah's been in-house more recently than I have.
Corinne sticks very much to like the strategy side, which I'm deeply jealous of. And I get to go in and do the operations side over and over again. And the problems just keep compounding. Because the reality is right now we have five generations in the workforce. It's, I think it was last year that it became six. It might be this year. Because you do still have some of the silent generation in the workforce, mm-hmm. not a ton, but some. And the expectation from those generations are dramatically different.
Yeah.
And as a elder millennial, I think they're calling us.
You're an elder.
I'm an elder millennial, but they're also calling us geriatric millennials now, which I just can't. I can't get them. But
I'm a middle-aged millennial. I don't know.
Right. But as a geriatric millennial, you know, even I, as someone who deeply studies how work happens, am going, why don't these Gen Alphas just get things done, right? And they are getting things done. It's just in a very different way,
right.
And in a way that is demanding change.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably one of the big reasons we wrote this book, and probably one of the big reasons it should have been written decades earlier, yeah. is the only thing that's constant is change. And as soon as laptop computers hit, something huge was going to have to happen, because the ability to shift into different types of workplaces was going to be a reality. Yeah. It was just that the boomers, the silent generation, some of the elder millennials were going, look, we had to be in an office, so do you.
Yeah.
And that's just not the reality, right? And yeah. and it's not the real, I'm going to say it's not the reality all the time. I think every single one of us can see the benefit to being in an office sometimes, to being together sometimes, and to specific jobs, being in an office maybe all the time, right? But we have to open the possibilities of what that means for different types of jobs.
Yeah.
So Corinne, I hope I answered the question. I kind of lost track of answering at that point. So my passion sometimes takes over. So Corinne, is there anything else to fill in there?
Yeah, I think for me, again, why it was important to really talk about work is because those fundamentals about how work is getting done is it's changing so rapidly today. So even what I'm doing as someone who's 15, 16 years into their career, how I'm going about it today is radically different than what I was doing 5 years ago, 10 years ago. And so that sort of change compounds. But if you're a silent generation or a boomer, by the time like you are most likely in a position where like I've been doing this in a certain way for 15 to 20 years, and I'm not going to stop now because I'm 5 years away from retiring, or you know, or
well,
so there's this entrenchment.
Break. I'm sorry to interrupt you, Corinne, but habit is hard to break.
Right.
Well, you and I have at least both read The Power of Habit and how hard it is to build also.
Right.
That I get it. And those are the people that are likely in power.
Yeah. So there's a weightedness to these older generations because by and large, those are the ones that are still in power and driving the ship of this is what work is. This is where it happens. This is how it should happen. When meanwhile, there is just an ongoing increasing, you know, database or, you know, source of that not being true anymore. And so it's really this, I certainly had to sort of moderate my understanding of like, it's an us versus them kind of struggle. Mm-hmm. Because in some ways it still is, but our goal with the book is how do we take that emotion? Because there is a ton of emotion that's written into it of, you know, a lot of social issues that stretch beyond what you show up to your job to do. So how do we sort of neutralize those struggles and focus on what are the jobs to be done? Mm-hmm. And basically just, you know, only use the facts, because there are obviously always going to be people that only operate out of emotion. But if we can sort of gather enough data and move in that direction of not everything is going to be solved, not everything's going to be perfect, but we know that this can be done successfully in this kind of way. Yeah. And just sort of building from there as a way to build a foundation of trust, because I'm forgetting the number, but the Edelman trust score that came out earlier this year, employee trust in leaders and employee trust in organizations is lower than it's ever been. Mm-hmm. I think it might be like maybe 25%.
And trust is built by listening, right?
So there's this echo chamber on the leadership side, not listening to the needs of those younger generations. So in many ways, this is our sort of olive branch of how can leaders who are even remotely interested in trying to remedy the situation, how can they go about it in a systematized way that isn't just that traditional, let's give employees, you know, let's throw the benefits and the perks at the employees to make them happy. Let's focus on making them effective, because if we're actually empowering people to do the work they signed on to do, it usually has a pretty decent, you know, derivative on, are you happy?
A ping pong table is great, but I'm not going into the office for a ping pong table.
Right.
Do you think there are any policies that or specific behaviors that companies can do to kind of level the playing field generationally and just generally build better trust? Or is this just, you know, a lot of pain for the foreseeable future?
Yes, I would say, I mean, the short answer is listen to your employees. That saying that sentence, though, is very overwhelming for a lot of people and a lot of organizations, because it's like, one, because there's a data literacy problem in most organizations of understanding how to leverage the amount of data they collect on their workforce. So that's one challenge, is like increase your data literacy to make sense of the data you already have. And then, you know, then you kind of have some answers of like, what are the things that are getting in your employees' way? You know, you're always going to have a very easy to access set of, this is a consistent problem. And, you know, you can matrix it in the, you know, it's low effort, high impact. Anything that can get categorized as low effort, high impact, do them tomorrow. And if they're, you know, high effort, but high impact, let's figure out how we can implement them over the next 6 months, over the next 9 months, whatever that might be. And then obviously everything else either gets parking lot or it's not worth it. And so we're going to just set it to the side. So listen to your employees, but really go through the data of what they're already telling you. And even if it's not them verbalizing it, what are the things that keep getting in the way? And that to me is how you design good employee experience without over-indexing on the snacks and the parties and the swag and all the things that I think get conflated to being employee experience, and focusing on, you know, we have a business to run. How do we make sure, how do we streamline and how do we make, you know, make what we have able to achieve the objectives? without burning our workforce out, without pissing them off, because, you know, they are essential. We do need them. So that would be, I think, our probably like first recommendation is like, you already have the answers in your organization. And that's also why we didn't want to give answers in the book, is because those answers are going to be different organization to organization. But the way to get there is pretty unilateral.
Totally. The other thing I'm going to hop into, in addition to listen, is look within. Mm. There is so much fear driving decisions right now. And, you know, I think no one would call it fear. They'd call it, you know, effectiveness, or this is how we've always run the business, or whatever that might be. But ultimately, if I'm going to give an example, if you're a manager that has never truly had management training and or doesn't truly know how to measure the work, you've been watching your employees for decades. You're like, wait, how am I going to do this effectively and do my job as a manager effectively without watching everyone? That's a fear.
Yeah,
that's, you know, there's something innately wrong with how you're ultimately managing the work, because watching isn't getting stuff done. But right.
Overseeing doesn't mean they're being productive. Right.
Exactly. But changing your ways, ultimately, there's a fear you may not succeed at how you manage their work when you're actually doing it in a way that could be more effective. So a lot of the decisions that are being made right now are being driven by fear. Now, I'm not going to say all of them because, you know, like I said, there's plenty of companies that should be in office and should have that watching methodology. But that's why we tried to write the book in the way we did, where it's look inside, not it's right or wrong to be watching.
Yeah, there's a couple of companies I've been running with recently, and I think watching your workforce is absolutely critical. They found that, you know, they didn't need to be in every day, but they definitely needed to be in based on a lot of surveys and watching like 3 to 4 days a week. Totally. And there was another company I was with that they realized they need to be in every day, and there was one I've been running with for a while that realized they need to be in like 1 to 2 days a week. And I think there's a wide range, and a lot of it depends on how they're engaging in the workplace.
Yeah.
And there's no formula.
Yeah. And actually one conversation I recently had comes up on this based on your book, which is you talk about like the different modes of knowledge work. And I think this plays heavily into how often you need to come in.
Very much so.
One of the businesses that needs to come in more than the others is it's a very creative business where there's a lot of informal huddle meetings that people are having, and they just need to be in the office together talking and hashing things out. It's basically a writer's room. Right. And you know, one of the other businesses is a tech business that doesn't really need that. I'm curious, could you dive into kind of the different modes of knowledge work that are described in the book? Because if there's an HR professional that's listening to this podcast, I think they're going to sit there and go like, wow, this is very informative on kind of how our business is structured.
For sure. Yeah. So I can't remember the origin of like what made me start thinking about knowledge work in this particular, it's tied to my WeWork days, but I noticed through the past 6 or 7 years, we were becoming, or it was WeWork, because I was sort of splitting the workforce into two sections. One that was more technical, and so that's obviously the engineers and it's security. But I was also counting like the architects and designers in that category as well. They got a little upset with me, but once I explained why, they're like, "We're very creative." I'm like, "Yes, you are," but their workflows were so highly technical that they needed more of that synchronous time together. And, you know, could those be changed and evolved to be more asynchronous and more sort of flexible? Totally. But the way that WeWork was working at that time, they were the ones who needed like to be co-located, excuse me, and basically paired programming together. So side by side kind of work. Whereas teams like mine, which were research and development, and conceptual design. So coming up with these, you know, new approaches to workplace. First, we were already dispersed. My boss was based in Portland. Some of us were in New York. So we already had a more distributed model. And we, amongst ourselves, came up with our own sort of ways of working. Because we were inherently asynchronous, we needed to have clearer expectations of one another. Of like, okay, you know, the workday in New York starts then. Let's not expect Adam to be emailing us at what would be 5 a.m. his time. So, you know, because we were more asynchronous, we had to take that, like, take those extra steps to give ourselves more structure. But the thing that really, I think, triggered all of this thinking for me was WeWork headquarters in New York City was so loud. This was a case study that we have in the book. It was so loud. It was honestly... It was honestly the place where I realized I'm actually an introvert. you know, I'm in my late 20s. I'm like, wait a minute. I don't think I'm as extroverted as I think I am because I run away any chance I get. And so I was noticing that of like a lot of people just clamoring for any sort of quiet space because it was a very overstimulating environment. And when I was redesigning that workplace, I like fought very hard for we needed to have like a computer lab, essentially. People are like, okay, cool. Yeah, we'll make like 10 tables. I'm like, no, it needs to be 100. They're like, why 100? I'm like, it needs to be that big so that people know that that quiet space will always be available. Because what are the odds of, you know, every single seat in that environment being filled up? And so that was really my biggest fear is that, you know, unassigned, always available quiet space being oversubscribed. And thankfully, it never really was. So it delivered on exactly what people needed. And that was for the individual focus piece of things. It was the reliable place where people weren't hogging phone booths or camping out in meeting rooms. It was the place to go do the quiet work. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, those are the three. And then the socializing piece is the one that I think has become more and more important post-COVID, because I think we're all good at the work stuff of like, okay, we know how to synchronously, most of us know how to synchronously collaborate. We know how to asynchronously collaborate. And we definitely know how to do our individual work. But we've sort of lost the importance, lost the meaning of what socializing means and the value that it holds in knowledge work. And it's not, again, not just the big parties that the company hosts. It's the, you know, standing in line for coffee with someone and, or just even just passing them in the hallways or just knowing who's who. So whether it's you're at a company that's anchored to a physical space in some way, or you're remote, you have a way of navigating the organization and having tentacles across the board. Cause that's the stuff, like that's how the silos kind of get reinforced when that's absolutely the last thing that needs to happen. So for me, that breaking down of knowledge work was really important because we don't really talk about work in those categories. We talk about all these things as activities and stuff that we do, but we don't know, we as workplace folks and just organizations in general, don't really know how to accommodate very well for all these different types of work. And we saw it with the open plan that was supposed to be for like collaboration and innovation. And it just turned out to be loud and overstimulating and actually more distracting. So a lot of this is like, you know, more trial and error.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's, you know, a lot of what we know is just because we've done this stuff and we've realized, oh no, this isn't it. So, you know, it's not that we have achieved the golden ticket either. It's that like, you know, we are sort of piecemealing the hard lessons that we've learned, the wins that we've had, and saying like, we know that these are the components of what success can look like. And so, you know, talking about knowledge work in this particular sort of dissected way just feels a little more tangible because knowledge work can sound very amorphous and loosey goosey. But if we're talking about how do we design for individual focus, we have clearer answers. How do we design for asynchronous collaboration? We also can come up with clearer answers. Knowledge work is just, it's too enormous.
Yeah. And I think one of our biggest realizations in putting together these work modes, because we're not the first to think about work in different modes, right? There's lots of different work mode models out there. But I think one of our biggest realizations in putting together the work modes was there are multiple different types of collaboration. Let's stop saying we need to be in person to collaborate. Yes, for synchronous collaboration, maybe we do. But for asynchronous collaboration, maybe we don't. There are things that can get done in that way. And so we really thought of it on, you know, two different pendulums. When we need to be together, what things are we doing? We're either socializing or participating in synchronous collaboration. When we're solo, what type of things might we be doing? Individual focus or asynchronous collaboration? And then you think about, like, what's more organic? So the socializing is probably going to be more organic, like Corinne was just saying. It's going to be having a random conversation all the way up to going to an event. And individual focus is probably going to be more organic. You're thinking through how you're going to get something done versus more structured. Your collaboration is probably going to be more structured and more designed.
Yeah.
And so I think we wanted people to have that model for where do these activities fall so that they could start to think about where the place might be.
Yeah. And being and kind of thinking about, like, what's hybrid 2.0. I think we never really said it in those words, but hybrid 1.0 in some ways has struggled because there's just been the assumption that every day is the same as every other day. But if you are Tuesday through Thursday in the office, should you be doing the same exact work that you're doing when you're sitting at your home office or at a coffee shop or wherever? And so giving, again, having this particular language, we wanted to offer that as a way to say, you know, teams, start designing your in-office days to support synchronous collaboration and socializing. So don't expect people to be at their computers plugging away. Expect them to be in the meeting rooms, visioning stuff. So like having coffees and meeting with people. So just, you know, other ways to frame, or maybe just new ways to frame, how do you design your day?
So when you talk about designing your day, one of the big things that comes up in the book and has come up in a number of other articles and books I've read is productivity versus effectiveness. And I know we had one employee who was a broker on our team, and they would mention in the past, you know, hey, I sent out this many emails, I did blah, 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 I've made this many cold calls. And at the end of the day, we're like, you're just not bringing in business. I don't care that you sent out 100 emails today and you made 50 cold calls. You're just doing busy work. Right. How do we differentiate between, like, truly productive versus effective business modes? Because I think that's ultimately what we're looking at when we're deciding between, like, what work works and what work is just busy work.
Yeah, there's sort of two threads on that. Sarah, I want you to take the outputs and outcomes piece, but I'm going to talk about productivity and effectiveness as, like, because it'll answer, Gordon, specifically your example right there. What I'll talk about is more, organizations need to kind of just assume that there is inherent friction or just like weighted vests on their employees. And there's just stuff that interferes with them and their capacity to be productive. So, you know, we use the example of by and large, too many people have too many meetings, too many days in a row. So that's like one of our examples of, like, at what point are those meetings just busy work, or, you know, and, you know, what makes a quality meeting? So I talk about productivity and effectiveness as what can the organization do to facilitate effectiveness in a way of taking certain weights off of the weighted vest to let people move in a more unencumbered way. Because then when it comes to evaluating performance, you get to say, we know that we are teeing you up in X, Y, and Z ways. So, like, we know that these blockers that used to be there are not there anymore. And so we are expecting some sort of percentage increase in capacity or, you know, creativity, whatever that metric might be. But in terms of like calibrating expectations and output, Sarah, I'm going to toss to you.
Yeah. So I think we talk a lot in the book about outputs versus outcomes, right? And outputs are ultimately not very human, if I'm saying it in the simplest way possible, because it's driven from the old Ford production line, right? Of how many parts did you get off the production line in an hour, similar to your broker, yeah. Where it's like, yeah, you got 100 emails out, but do we need your humanness to do that? Ultimately, no, we could probably use AI to do that. We need your humanness to drive the outcomes, which are actually getting new business in the term of your broker, or getting the car fully put together in the terms of the Ford factory line. We're in the fourth industrial revolution. Am I right, Corinne? Is it fourth or are we in fourth? Yeah, okay.
Fourth.
She studies
as of like 10 years ago.
I would like go off on her about like, wait, we should be using computers to do this. And she's like, you're talking about the fourth industrial revolution. So we're in the fourth industrial revolution, and we should be using computers, AI, machinery to get done the things that don't require our humanness. And so that would mean we're really driving towards those outcomes of how to more effectively produce more cars with the tools that we have, which are AI and mechanical tools and all sorts of things, versus actually pulling things off the assembly line anymore. And so that's I diving into outputs versus outcomes, I think is really all about shifting into our humanness.
Which coincides with AI.
Can I dive into that a little bit more?
Sure.
Because I think that's a big concept. So so what would you really ultimately define as shifting into your humanness?
Yeah. So I think, honestly, let's go back to your last question. It's about becoming more effective without making yourself as a human do more.
Yeah. I've been doing a lot of separate research on AI and digital transformation. And what keeps coming up is, you know, the future of the hybrid workforce, not hybrid, where are you located, like hybrid artificial versus human. So the future of those hybrid workforces are letting humans lean into the things that human nature is excellent at. And it's nonlinear, creative, project management type things, you know, being the sort of the overseer, not necessarily like the one in the weeds. And so, you know, things that we wouldn't necessarily think, I think, unless you're doing this kind of work, like it's not necessarily what everyone would think humans naturally are. We are naturally creative. Not everyone's an artist, but we are creative. And so leaning into what might that look like in a corporate setting, in a marketing group, or in a sales group, or. And where AI is very good is the stuff that humans are not very good at, which is, you know, highly repetitive, highly detailed work where, you know, historically we always have like factors of like margins of error because the human brain can only have capacity for, you know, a certain level of detail. Obviously, you can train yourself and all that kind of stuff, but there is a ceiling. So the future of the workforce, and obviously there are, we have a little bit of tunnel vision in this conversation of like, there's a lot of other big ethical things happening around AI, but
And we don't have to cover all of them.
We don't have time for that. We don't have time for that. We don't necessarily have the expertise for it. But like, you know, just putting those things to the side, the future of that hybrid workforce is basically taking out that really monotonous, highly detailed stuff that then allows the human to come in and be the relationship builder and owner and, you know, do the things that aren't as highly technical because humans are not actually highly technical, period. You know, some of us are very highly technical, but in comparison to
the machine,
machine learning and AI, it pales in comparison. So that's a way further out future scenario. But those are things that, like, you know, in other pockets of the future of work, like, those are conversations that are being had about how do those workforces come together? How do they collaborate? Who does, you know, who or what does what?
So on the, and Sarah, you can go ahead. I don't mean to interrupt.
No, I was just giggling because I'm feeling so, I guess lucky that we're living in a day and age where we get to think about things this way, right? Like,
yeah.
Technology matures so quickly, and yes, it's scary, but it's also like, oh my gosh, we get to think about a new way to do things. And I think every generation gets to think about a new way to do things, but wow, the robots are real, people.
So when we're talking about the robots being real and, like, new ways of doing things, one of the ways I thought the book put well, kind of how the comparison is, and mm-hmm. is kind of the idea of the carpenter and the gardener. Can you kind of dive into that a little bit more?
Sure.
It's kind of
my baby.
A way of...
baby, so yeah.
Yeah.
So it started with, I've heard that on a podcast, a Hidden Brain NPR podcast, like 8 or 9 years ago. And I immediately translated it to, oh, this could easily be used as a proxy for an employee's relationship to their organization or to their leader and vice versa.
And she says easily used, she had to try and train me first how to use it. And I think it took us 3 days of continuous conversation. So, like, yes, easily, but, you know,
easy for this brain here. And so the carpenter and the gardener, I've always just really liked the paradigm. So just for a quick debrief for listeners, this is based on psychology research done by a Berkeley professor. And she wrote a book about this parenting paradigm. So the spectrum of how people parent their kids. And I think her research was specific to the U.S. And so the carpenters are, you know, highly regimented, very meticulous, and they have goals in mind. They, you know, this kid is going to have a 4.2 GPA and is going to get into every single Ivy League, and they choose of their, you know, of their will. Or this kid is going to be in the NBA, and so we're going to do everything that we can to get them into, you know, leagues and all that kind of stuff, and just engineer that specific outcome. But the downside of that approach is those kids only know how to do those things that they've been highly trained for. So, you know, if you're like a classical pianist, you only know how to be a classical pianist. You don't know how to wash your underwear, or you don't know how to, like, cook at least some eggs. So, like, she was highlighting that of, like, there's high specialty, but then there's real deficiency in other areas. And then on the other end is the gardener, which is basically, we've got a solid foundation. We know we have irrigation, you know, everything is as set up as it can be. And also there's hail and rodents and all these things. And we need to figure out, you know, we need to have the resources available and sort of the wherewithal to adapt when circumstances change. And that's harder to do in that carpenter analogy because you're engineering for very specific outcomes. So that means you need to go back to the drawing board and start from scratch, as opposed to that sort of layered evolutionary approach like we mentioned earlier. So that's been a paradigm I've had in my head for now almost a decade. So I've used it with, like, leadership coaching. I've used it for thinking about organizational culture and what can be done, and, you know, how we can foster a more gardener relationship, which, you know, jury's out. We'll see how we keep going. But that's really where it came from, is like, what are the circumstances where we can let go and let things evolve and adapt? And what are the things that are just, they are what they are for, you know, regulatory purposes or, you know, whatever that might be, that they need to be engineered in a specific way for a specific reason.
And I think we all have to step into some carpenters,
totally.
Especially those of us in middle management. Generally speaking, you end up with your leadership teams that are more on the spectrum towards carpenter. And your teams on the ground getting stuff done that are more on the spectrum towards gardener. And the more that we can bring those together, the more we're going to have an effective environment.
So one of the worst elements, I think, of kind of the carpenter mindset is the push sometimes for unnecessary meetings.
Yeah.
I'm curious, could you dive into kind of the hidden meeting tax that occurs in some businesses and kind of what
you're studying?
Yeah.
So like what some folks have done about it at like Shopify and Dropbox and some of the big players in the market.
Yeah. So I think a lot of data was, I think it was first Microsoft that came out with this data early in 2021 of like the percentage of meetings spiked by like 250%. A little asterisk with that data is meetings might have been happening at that volume prior, but they weren't virtual. So that, you know, it was new data for Microsoft through 2020 because everyone was using Teams. So, you know, conditioning aside, we were having more and more meetings post, like once COVID hit, because we didn't know how to fill the time when we weren't with each other in the office. So there was sort of this like,
or get the,
yeah. So it was this compulsive need, I think, to fill the time, not necessarily from a monitoring standpoint, but people didn't know how to work from home. And then that sort of just calcified into this is how we work. This is how we work from home, or this is how we work remotely, is every single block of time is booked from like 8 o'clock in the morning to 6 o'clock at night. And so, you know, it was just, it was crazy. We all lived it.
The problem is it's persisted.
Right.
Right.
So that's where this has become a big challenge, is that the behaviors have persisted, even though we, you know, many companies have some form of hybrid. So there is just, you know, a stack of meetings every single day, which is part of why there's a challenge to hybrid in the first place, of if you're expecting me to just sit on meetings all day, What is the specific value of me being in an office to do exactly what I do from home at this, you know, at the same performance rate, which is, I think, a very justifiable, rebuttal, because there isn't a clear answer yet, which is, again, is also why we wanted to map out knowledge work and digital workplace and physical environments and all that kind of stuff.
But it proves it also proves that socialization has been deprioritized.
Yes.
Because all of these meetings, this collaboration stuff on the side, whether it should be happening virtually and or in person or whatever, the other stuff is just as important. And the individual work, yes, it's got to happen. So right. That's going to get done. But the socializing is what holds it all together.
Yeah. But I think the other challenge too is, you know, meetings, I treat meetings as like an invasive species, because they don't, like, you don't actually have time to do your individual work unless it's in off hours. Like if you're in back-to-back meetings, you're either not paying attention in the meetings you're in, which I understand, but you know, there's only so much time in a day for you to get the actual work done. And if you're being expected to show up to meetings and do the work, you're kind of in this, you're in this constant push and pull. So that's the conflict. All the data shows that we have, you know, we experience, you know, increasing rates of burnout as a result of meetings in general, partly because most meetings are not designed for outcomes. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't have things that are really engineered towards like, okay, we're here in this hour to talk about these set things with these set people to achieve X by the end of it. So there's most meetings don't follow that formula. So that means that like we kind of just accumulate more and more as the can gets kicked down the road and all that kind of stuff. But some companies, sorry, you wanted to say something.
So I was just saying, I think like the best case study of like where you kind of have informal meetings that work well in your book, and this is something that's very true with how we operate as well. I mean, I'm a huge fan of going and getting lunch with our team and sitting yep. down in our cafe and just just shooting the shit,
yeah.
pardon my French, and sitting there and just talking about generally what's going on and yep. having people toss out ideas. And I think you do a great case study in Hulu of like snack mastery and the whole idea of like workplaces as relationships. Yeah. And I'd be curious if you could dive into that, because I think that's one of the elements of like where it's not a meeting, but it's like a workplace relationship where you're actually getting work done, and particularly creative work.
Yeah.
And if you could dive into that, I think that would be very helpful for some of our listeners.
Yeah. So Hulu, obviously pre-COVID, right? So we were all there. So that advantage was there because we were able to be together. It was an innately creative environment. So the desire to talk to each other and bounce ideas off of each other was also there. So I recognize some of the benefits that we had. But I think that we also took a very clear deliverable from our culture team that we were building to create those for people. How do we inspire people? Yeah. Knowing that inspiration was part of our DNA, was part of the culture. We said, how do we inspire people? And Hulu, I'll just give a quick overview of the story, specifically said, okay, yes, every other company in Los Angeles that is creative is supplying lunch for their team members. We're not going to. And we're not going to because we want people to be creative. And we're going to supply an inordinate amount of snacks. There was an unbelievable...
Basically ingredients.
It was basically ingredients throughout every pantry within the office. And they were central locations for people to come together and see what people do with it. And people created lunch, as you would, right? Like, this is a perk that exists everywhere else and technically a benefit because you're saving money by not having to purchase lunch. They wanted to take advantage of that. And it got so omnipresent throughout the company that a snack cookbook got created within Hulu, where, you know, you could make everything from a grilled cheese sandwich to nachos to like all sorts of fun stuff. And there were, if you needed it faster than the creativity that would have been required to produce lunch from the snacks, there was also a lunch provider there and it was heavily subsidized and all of that. But ultimately that served the culture of the company. And wasn't just, we're going to give you free food. It was, we're going to drive business results by not giving you free food, but giving you all the things that might be able to be developed into a free meal. It's about that creativity in the background, right?
Well, I'm not surprised that Hulu has so many food-based shows now. you know, shout out to the Bear as a Chicagoan. In terms of that, one of the things though that, you know, that we look at is our whole workplace as a whole, and it's ultimately, right, it's kind of a living system, and we don't want it to suck. And that's why we're on this podcast today.
That's why we're here. That's right.
So how do we make it ultimately not suck?
You want to go first there?
Sure. I think innately the word work has become synonymous with something that sucks, right? And so really being able to step back and say, I am one of the lucky ones that gets to do what I love is where we have to aim for. And not everyone is going to be working for a company or a product or whatever that speaks to what they love, right? Like some people say you love sports. Some people get to work for Nike and they're like, I'm happy. That's where I'm at. But say you love sports and you're working for Netflix. You're like, okay, what is it really that I love? And it's probably being able to work and deliver in the way that speaks to you. And so that's ultimately what we're trying to develop is how do we make work suck less by getting to do what you love, even if it's not, you know, what you're maybe going to answer at a dinner party that you love, you're still going to say you love your job if you get to do it in a way that makes sense for you.
Yeah. I think for me, There's a section early in the book where we talk about definitions, and I'll keep it brief, but we talk a bit about the difference between experiencing and remembering. Mm-hmm. And this all, like, this ties to a part of our brain that where our fight and flight reactions live. So it's in your amygdala. So basically, like, what was trained over millennia to keep us safe from panthers is now sort of like what triggers the I don't like this or this sucks. And the goal is really for us to figure out what are things that would trigger and not, you know, trigger frustration, friction. And so that's really why I always try to focus on if we can, you know, if we can facilitate someone, you know, doing what they love, that's, you know, that's top of the, like, top of the line. But, you know, for, I think the baseline of what we need to focus on doing is how do we get things out of the way so that people have at least a neutral relationship with their job, mm-hmm. you know, because maybe their passions are something that are so far removed from their job, but they need their job for insurance, money, whatever that might be. How do we make sure that they are enabled to show up and do what they need to do and do it well? So that way it's not the drain, it's not a drain on their energy and they get to go spend it with their family or with their, you know, with their creative projects, or they go back to school. So that for me, it's, there's like, that's, I think my primary goal is how do we reduce those things so people have more agency over how they spend their time and energy? Even though work is the lion's share of where they spend it, how do we make sure that the rest of their time, they have the wherewithal to go and use it rather than just, you know, rot on your couch or your bed every weekend just to start over and do it again? That's my goal.
When you're fighting against something you hate because you have to do it, you're a lot more tired.
Yeah.
Than when you go do something that you...
You're like, yeah, that's my job.
Boy, or is your job. And then you have the energy to do those things that you truly are passionate about after.
Yeah.
So I'm passionate about asking questions on this podcast and really digging into commercial real estate and the way we work. But we've got two final ones. Now, the first one is, and this is one of my favorites, is what's one thing in commercial real estate, and this one was for both of you, that we should be talking about that we haven't discussed today on the podcast?
You go first, Sarah. I got it.
Oh, gosh. I think, frankly, I think commercial real estate is behind. If you look at almost everything else...
We do as well. That's part of the reason for the podcast. So.
You look at almost everything else in the world, it's become self-serve. And commercial real estate hasn't. And it's because of awesome people like you that help lead us through that process, right? But I think that there is, we got to figure out how it's going to evolve in a way that helps the people that need commercial real estate and the maybe ideas that we haven't even found out yet of how commercial real estate can be used, and all of those things can start to get married better, so that commercial real estate isn't this black hole of trying to figure it out anymore. It's easier for companies and businesses and individuals, maybe even like how can individuals better use commercial real estate? I don't know. I haven't thought of it, but commercial real estate would. I walked into a mall the other day and there was a daycare center on the entire top floor. And I was like, oh, that's cool. But did someone think of that and start, you know, making it more accessible or, you know, so I just think we really got to move commercial real estate forward into the new age of how humans expect to be able to engage with a business.
Yeah. For me, I was thinking a lot about this when I was at RXR and I was on the landlord side of just, you know, I look forward to the day where commercial real estate and urban planning are in the same room and on the same side of the table, because they're usually not. I think, you know, I think there's a friendly relationship, but not a collaborative one. Mm-hmm. And I think so much, and obviously commercial real estate exists outside of urban centers, but I think there is such a huge opportunity to think about commercial real estate and its role in urban design in a way that, most commercial real estate says, yeah, yeah, but that's public and, you know, there's no revenue there. And so we're not going to. I really look forward to the day where like those scales get more balanced and we get to really talk about city design, because that's something that is, it's going to become more and more important, but also like that it unlocks so much. And we get to, you know, redefine what cities look like. So in another life, that would have been a place I went.
And like purposefully redesign what cities look like. Yes. I've seen drawings recently of like old office buildings that they're trying to turn into apartments. That's not what
we're talking about either. Yeah, no. I'm talking a bit bigger than that.
Yeah. We've covered a lot of those and we're going to bring more on the podcast. But the last question, and this is, you know, just as important as any, is if somebody wants to reach out to you, learn more about you or your book, what are the best ways to get in contact? And we'll leave a link for your book below in the comments and both on there as well as our blog.
Yeah. So the book's available for sale at Amazon.com. Easiest way to get it, but it's also in bookstores everywhere. We do have a website, workthenplace.com. You can submit a inquiry there, or you can email us at info@workthenplace.com.
Yep. And we'll be releasing some updates on, I've been doing a Substack of just like excerpts from the book, some of the behind the scenes stuff from the book. So that's workthenplace.substack.com.
Great. Thank you so much for coming. Thank you so much for coming on today. We really appreciate it. And we got to do it again.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Gordon. This was great.
Thanks again to Corinne and Sarah. We appreciate their insights. And if you enjoyed the podcast, please give us a like, a 5-star rating, and a review. Your comments, interactions, and subscriptions truly matter and help us continue to get quality guests. You can find us on YouTube, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gordon Lamphere with the Real Finds Podcast. Thank you for listening.